Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for dropping along tonight to the Sydney Institute to hear a talk on Martin Sharp. Now, Joyce Morgan makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. She's a former editor of the Sydney, a former arts editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, a journalist and author of Journeys on the Silk Road. Joyce Morgan is based in Sydney. She's worked as a journalist in London, in Hong Kong, and of course in Sydney, and has written on arts and culture for more than two decades. And she's here on the occasion of the recent publication of her book, Martin Sharp, His Life and Times. And the topic for tonight's talk is Martin Sharp taking on the establishment. Many thanks.
Well, thanks, Gerard, and thank you all for coming along. It's a great pleasure to make my Sydney Institute debut here and to talk about Martin Sharp taking on the establishment. Martin Sharp, he was a Sydney artist, and he learned very early the effect of taking on a high-profile figure, a man of authority. As a teenager at Sydney's Cranbrook School, Sharp painted a portrait of the school's most formidable teacher. It was Sharp's housemaster and his English teacher, and his name was Mr. Bell, or Cheery Bell, as the boys used to call him, presumably ironically, because Mr. Bell was a man of a few words, and he was a very commanding figure, scholarly and stern. Before the misdemeanours that the boys committed, he would make them polish his bookcases. So he's slightly eccentric. Anyway, Martin painted a very impressive portrait of his teacher, and it was so impressive that his art master, Justin O'Brien, who was an artist in his own right, he hung it temporarily on the school's staircase. And there it caused quite a stir as staff and students crowded round to see it. It was a bold and cheeky portrait, and no student had dared before to depict any teacher before, let alone the school's most revered. And it portrayed the schoolmaster in his classroom, and in the background was a young boy polishing the bookcases. Reflecting on it years later, Sharp told me that that was the moment that he realised his art could have an impact. And, of course, Sharp's art did have an impact far beyond the cloistered world of his public school, private school, sorry, we should say here. He was Australia's only international pop artist, but he was also a filmmaker, a lyricist, a cartoonist, a satirist, an eccentric, and a fearless social observer. When he was in his early 20s, the media dubbed him the White Ant of Bellevue Hill. And it was rather an appropriate name, description, because when Sharp took on the establishment, and I'll look at some examples shortly, he did so as an insider. Martin was born in 1942. He was a war baby. And he was raised in one of Sydney's most wealthy families. They were pillars of the establishment. On his mother's side, they were industrialists. Sharp's maternal forebears included a member of the New South Wales Legislative Assembly and a head of the Iron Trades Association. The wealth of that side of the family, the Ritchie family, came from railways. They made rolling stock and tracks, and they made some of the red rattlers that we used to rattle across Sydney. Sharp's grandfather was a man by the name of Stuart Ritchie, And he sat, and he was the wealthiest of them all, and he sat on the board of Comsteel alongside Essington Lewis. And it was Stuart Ritchie who bought the mansion we're in Bellevue Hill, the mansion that Shaw inherited and lived in for more than 30 years until he died in 2013. Interestingly, on Martin's father's side, there was a competing strain. The first Sharp to arrive in Australia, Martin's great-grandfather, was a printer, and he became the president of the Trades and Labour Council and a founder of what became the Australian Labour Party, and he held the seat of Redfern. But the next generation, the politics changed, and Sharp's paternal grandfather was a Vaucluse alderman. He was a supporter of the United Australia Party, and he was a founder of Cranbrook School. He was also a prominent doctor, as there were many medical men on the Sharp side of the family, including Martin's father. So on one side you've got captains of industry, on the other side you've got medical men. Sharp, of course, was never likely to enter either medicine or industry. He was not very good at all at maths or science. And when he left school, he trained in art. He began making a name as a cartoonist, including for the student magazines, Sydney University's Oigny Soir, and for the UNSW's student magazine called The Runker. And he also did some work for The Bulletin. He was among a group of students who decided in 1963 to start a satirical magazine. And this would be a magazine that would sell to the public. It wasn't going to be given away for free like most of the magazines he'd been working on. Of course, the name of that magazine was Oz. The magazine was launched, appropriately enough, on April Fool's Day, 1963. And it had a cover that Martin drew. He drew the Queen grinning like a Cheshire cat. And the monarchy, the church, politicians, the police, and police corruption were among Martin's favourite subjects for satire in the magazine, which quickly developed a capacity for outrage, not least for some of the covers that Martin drew for it. Yes, that was naughty, isn't it? it was a time when there wasn't a lot of criticism, let alone satire, about the monarchy. The times were different. They were more conservative. And the monarchy was not questioned, really. Australia was a different country. It was much more of an Anglo country, of course. It was towards the end of the Menzies era. But Australia had, at that stage, a young population. In 1960... about a third of the population were under 18. And there was an embryonic kind of youth culture beginning, and some people were hungry for change, not least Martin. But within a few months, the authorities did pounce on Oz magazine, and its three editors were charged with obscenity. And they pleaded guilty, and they copped a small fine. Now, Martin wasn't part of that, but his response, I think, was illuminating, because he was absolutely furious that the three editors had, rather than taking a stand and fighting the obscenity case, that they buckled and just copped a fine. But within a year, it was Sharp's cartoons that landed him and the Oz co-editors, who were then Richard Walsh and Richard Neville. It landed them in court, and they were charged with obscenity. And this time they did fight the charges in what became Australia's most high-profile obscenity case and something of a watershed case. It was this issue that caused all the trouble. Some of you will perhaps remember that image. What it was, for those who don't recognise it, around that time there'd been the sculptor Tom Bass had created a public fountain in what was the newly opened P&O building, just not very far from here on Hunter Street. And there was quite an outcry over that image. But that issue Martin had actually contributed at least 9 cartoons to, and that was what really prompted the court case. The cartoons he'd done, they satirised the media, religion and police corruption, you know, his favourite subjects. One cartoon in particular occupied much of the legal argument, and it was a monologue that, a sort of satirical monologue that Martin had done. It's sort of known as the word flashed round the arms. And it's very hard, it's hard to read, and it's written in the vernacular, in slang. But it was, what it told about was a group of drunken young yobbos who'd gatecrashed a party on the North Shore and committed a number of lewd and violent acts. And, I mean, today it looks rather tame if you can understand the slang in it at all. But, of course, this was a different era and a more censorious era. In the post-war Australia, there was a number of books were banned. Books such as D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover, J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, works by Huxley, Balzac. And books were banned and restricted, not just for their content, but also for their covers. A lot of pulp fiction works were banned because of the images on the cover. When that case came to court, Martin, in fact, saw a great deal of the Liverpool Street Courthouse in that week because there were 2 obscenity cases in progress, and he was the common factor in both of them. Because as well as for Oz, yes, it was a busy week for Martin, he also faced charges over a cartoon in Thrunka magazine, the University of New South Wales magazine. It was known as the Gas Lash, and it was also about drunken behaviour. Again, it's a monologue. Drunken behaviour of a group of young students. And the 2 cases in Thrunka and Oz, they actually ran back-to-back in the courthouse. And curiously, it was actually the Thurunka cartoon that made sharp front page news in the Sydney Morning Herald when it first appeared. And Sharp actually defended his cartoon in a letter to the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. But with the obscenity case, central to establishing obscenity was you had to convince that a publication had a tendency to deprave the morals of readers. That was at the heart of the matter. And Martin and the 2 co-editors, they launched a very spirited defence of their work. And they brought in about 17 witnesses over several days. And there were some very high-profile figures, not least from the establishment. They included witnesses for the defence. People who spoke in their favour included the warden of St Paul's at Sydney University, where Martin had actually been a resident for a couple of terms. They included the artist John Olson, and they included Miss Betty Archdale, who was the headmistress of Abbotsley School on the North Shore. And all of these witnesses said that the magazine wouldn't deprave the morals of readers, and they said that Sharp's cartoons had merit. Now, many of the witnesses actually had said exactly the same thing next door in the Thurunka case. In fact, when I looked at the papers, the court papers for each, I realised that in one sense the Thurunka case was a dress rehearsal for the Oz case, the much more high-profile Oz case. And Sharp received just a £10 fine over for Thurunka, and although it was only a small amount, he lodged an appeal and he did eventually win. But, I mean, it shows you something about his tenacity. But the stakes were much higher in the Oz case, partly because it circulated to the public and it circulated outside of Sydney. It circulated in a number of other capital cities. Anyway, in September 1964, the magistrate in the Oz case gave his verdict, and he considered that Martin's the cartoon monologue, he described it as filthy and disgusting, and he flagged that he intended to make an example of him and his co-editors. So the three of them were sentenced to up to 6 months in prison, all of them with hard labour. They didn't actually spend very much time. They spent a few hours in the cells underneath the Liverpool Street Court, and along came Martin's father, the doctor, Dr. Sharp, who bailed them out, and they lodged an appeal. When the appeal came around, they assembled a very impressive legal team. On the team included John Kerr, later Governor General, Edward St. John, and Neville Wran, later the Premier. And many of the witnesses made encore appearances, and they added some new ones for good measure. And the new ones included people like academic James Macaulay, the cartoonist Les Tanner, and the Herald's theatre critic Harry Kippax. So they fought this case very, very hard. And in the end, the judge, Judge Aaron Levine, he was persuaded by their arguments, and he overturned their convictions. And in his judgment, he acknowledged that community standards had changed. Of course, this was great news for the Oz Three, and they celebrated out of court with a bit of a knees outside court with a bit of a knees up. Sharp's reaction actually was typically barbed, and he later drew a cartoon for the Sydney Morning Herald of himself and Walsh and Neville with a little speech bubble. And he said, "Fancy Levine whitewashing us. Our careers are ruined." I mean, Sharp knew the value to a cartoonist of being controversial. Levine's judgment was widely welcomed, including by the Bulletin. And some years later, Edward St. John, who'd represented them, he described the Oz case as what he called a turning point in the law relating to censorship and obscenity in Australia. He said, because our laws and our courts had adopted a very repressive attitude. And he said, from then on, the law didn't change, but the administration of the law became less repressive in relation to what was regarded as permissible and what was not. In the wake of the case, Sharp left fairly soon afterwards for London. His final Oz cover alluded to another controversy in Sydney that had gripped the city and beyond, and that was the sacking of Ewan Utzon as architect of the Sydney Opera House. Now, Sharp had used Oz to defend Ewan Utzon and to skewer the political manoeuvrings that led to Utzon's departure. And he, in particular, he'd satirised the Minister of Public Works, Davis Hughes, who'd clashed so famously with Utzon. That battle over the Sydney Opera House, it resonated very deeply with Martin, both publicly and personally. Martin had become friends with the Utzon family, and especially with the architect's daughter, Lynn Utzon, who was also at art school. And interestingly, when Utzon secretly left Australia, the only people who knew the timing of his departure were actually Martin and Martin's mother, Jo Sharp. Jo was well connected, and she had arranged through contacts with Qantas to get the Utzon family on board their Qantas flight to evade the media, which is why there's no photos of Utzon actually boarding that plane out of Australia. So establishment contacts are very useful. Utzon's sacking and the aftermath of Oz, of course, led Martin to head overseas. And he went to London in the late 60s, 66, he headed to London. And there his targets shifted, and his cartoons became fewer as he transformed much more into an artist. He was associated with the counterculture and the underground, whatever you want to call it, the alternative society, and something of a hippie right down to his Afghan vest. But as he morphed into an artist, what he became particularly opposed to was the art establishment. He really disliked its fickleness and its elitism, and he rarely exhibited in galleries. He never had a regular art dealer, perhaps to his cost. He believed idealistically that art belonged to everyone. And he worked in a way that bypassed the art world. So he created not works for gallery exhibitions, but he created posters, he created album covers, and of course he created a lot of work for London Oz magazine, which he and Richard Neville had started up in over there. And part of his disdain for the art establishment and the museums and the galleries was that he felt they excluded the very figures and imagery that had inspired him. I mean, he loved comic figures like Mickey Mouse and Boothhead. And he drew no distinction between high art and low. And that's one reason he became involved in Sydney's Luna Park. Martin received the biggest commission of his life, and that was to paint the face of the funfair. And it came at a time when he was disenchanted in London with Oz magazine and disenchanted with London itself. So he came back to Australia. He loved Luna Park. For him, it was a pop art mecca where the comic figures he loved were celebrated. And he actually wrote an eloquent piece for Quadrant magazine in which he described what the funfair meant to him. And he referred to those comic figures and he said, you know, great as they are, the twinkle in their eye had excluded them from the more formal clubs of the celebrated, the art galleries and the museums and the libraries. And he felt that this neglect was a serious flaw. It was a blind spot in what he calls society's assessment of some of its finest cultural blooms. In fact, Martin became, he wrote quite a few pieces for Quadrant, and he even featured on the cover. He was not quite the poster boy, but he featured on the cover in a rather extraordinary image in which he was photographed at home with a possum on his head. But in 1979, while he was still working on the funfair, there was a fatal fire. And it took the lives of six boys and one man, the father of two of the boys. And that, for Martin, was the turning point in his life. In the wake of it, he became, many people's surprise who knew him early on, he became very religious. He developed a deep belief in forces of good and evil. And he saw the fire in symbolic and apocalyptic terms. I mean, certainly his Christianity surprised many who painted him as the young godless radical, you know. But more than that, he became convinced that the fire was no accident, that it had been deliberately lit, and that organised crime was involved. And he spoke out about the fire. It became the subject of his art. And this work, called Snow Job, is an allusion to his conviction that the causes of the fire had been covered up. Now, in the wake of it, he also became rather paranoid and reluctant to leave the house. Now, some felt that this was simply paranoia. Others felt he was justified to be wary, because he was telling anyone who'd listened that organised crime was involved. So he was making very powerful enemies. Not the sort of establishment of his early years, but if you like, the establishment of the society's underbelly. These very, very dangerous, potentially dangerous figures. And he started keeping extensive files, including on crime boss Saffron. He had clippings going back to the 50s. There were many inquiries into the fire, and questions were raised in Parliament about Saffron's alleged connections to it. Answers that, from Sharp's point of view, were inconclusive or inadequate. In the late 80s, by which time the media had largely lost interest in the fire, but Martin hadn't, and he spoke to the National Crime Authority, and it considered his theory that Abe Saffron, who by that time had been linked to seven other fires in Sydney, had coveted Luna Park, and it's very valuable real estate. And the NCA's report, when it was eventually tabled, It was scathing about the original police investigation that legitimate avenues of inquiry hadn't been pursued, but it found no evidence of dishonesty or corruption. And it singled out Sharp, who'd given evidence to it. It said he was well-motivated but obsessed, and that as a result his judgment had become clouded, if not warped. And it went on to say that his theories, while often extreme and eccentric, arose from public dissatisfaction with the original findings, which in this case was not without cause, it said. In 2007, though, the Sydney Morning Herald dropped something of a bombshell. Abe Saffron, who was by then dead, had been behind the fire, according to Saffron's niece. Now, we may never know what really happened, about how it happened or why. But Luna Park continued to haunt Martin to the end of his life. But a connection to another building and another battle, a battle from his early life, had a much happier ending, and that was the Sydney Opera House. Martin had always loved that building, and he believed that Utzon's treatment had been outrageous. And for Sharp, it was unfinished business. Australia by then had embraced the Opera House, but as the building approached its 25th anniversary in the 90s, by that stage, there was a willingness to somehow re-engage with the elderly Utzon. But beyond a few symbolic gestures, like a plaque in his name, nobody really knew how to do it or how to approach Utzon. At that time, the Opera House Trust had a new chair, a man called Joe Skrinsky, and he got a phone call out of the blue from Martin, who he sort of vaguely knew. And Skrinsky said to him, he told Skrinsky that Lynn Utzon, the architect's daughter, was in Australia, and she was staying with him at Wirrian, as she always did, and still does. Well, did until a few years ago, obviously. And he said, would Joe like to come and meet her? So the three of them had a meeting around Martin's kitchen table. And as a result of that, Lynn Utzon agreed to speak to her father about a way forward. So that meeting, Lynn told me when I interviewed her for the book, she said that really that was where everything started. So it laid a path for what was a reconciliation and a re-engagement with Utzon, which I think we all benefit from. In the latter half of his life, Sharp embraced some of the institutions he'd once targeted so spikily in his early years. He accepted an Order of Australia, and he came to admire the Queen greatly. He admired her sense of duty, and he admired her sense of service. And he believed in the Christian God that he'd once satirised. He never entirely embraced the art establishment, but the art establishment did begin to embrace him. And the year before he died, his portrait of the actor David Gulpilil was hung in the Archibald Prize. It didn't win, but it was hung there. I have to say, Martin never really had a coherent political vision, and not even his close friends knew how he voted. He was quite a contradictory and elusive figure in very many ways. And he was, above all, he was an artist, and his ideas, like his art, were something of a collage. They drew together very disparate elements. But what he was driven by was an unrelenting desire in his art and his life to reveal the truth as he saw it. And at times that meant taking on and challenging very powerful forces and certainly unorthodox thinking. And he retained to the end a willingness to speak up, no matter what the cost to him. So, thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.